case on the docket is Alfred Banks Jr. versus Commonwealth, and we have Ms. Zukersky and Mr. Stoller.
Okay, Ms. Zukersky, how much time would you like for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 times for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, great. Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Catherine French, and I represent Mr. Banks, who is here with me in court today. In this case, the warrant alleged that stalking occurred between April 14th and April 16th, 2014. Conduct that Mr. Banks conducted in the 1990s was, first of all, not admissible to show that it was one of 2 occasions within that April 14th to April 16th time period. So it was inadmissible for that reason. And if it was admissible, it was only admissible to go to intent or the relations for the parties. And if that was the case, then a jury instruction should have been given. Regardless, even if it did come in to prove one of the 2 prior occasions, to prove that stalking occurred between April 14th and April 16th, the evidence was insufficient to prove that there was 2 occasions of contact directed towards Ms. Bryan between April 14th and April 16th, 2016, as well as the evidence was insufficient to show that any fear that Ms. Bryan had, that even if she subjectively had that fear, the evidence was insufficient to prove objectively that it was a reasonable fear of death, sexual assault, or bodily injury.
Counsel, how is the Harwood case not controlling here in reference to the failure to object to the interruption of that prior event in the 90s in terms of one of the predicate offenses? There was objection in terms of the motion in limine, but it wasn't made when it came in for purposes of the predicate offense.
Actually, Your Honor, I would disagree because it wasn't, yes, there was a motion in limine that was denied, but then later on, the trial judge, at the conversation regarding the jury instructions, it was at that point that the trial court said, you know what, I'm kind of revisiting my ruling and I'm going to let it in to show the one of the 2 prior occasions. And at that time, on page 198 and 199 of the joint appendix, when the trial court changed the ruling saying that it was admissible to prove one of the occasions, the trial court acknowledged that Banks disagreed and would note Banks' exception. So there was an objection and there was a ruling, and the trial court acknowledged that there was this continual disagreement, including for that it was inadmissible regardless. So I would direct Your Honor to page 198 and 199 of the joint appendix, and I would argue that it shows that it was preserved there for purposes of the first assignment of error. In terms of the admissibility, prior bad acts are only admissible if it shows intent or a feeling of the accused. And in this case, based on the specific assignments of error raised in the appeal, we're saying that if it came in for that purpose, there's no assignment of error regarding that it couldn't come in for that purpose. But if it came in for that purpose, then there needed to have been a jury instruction on that, which relates to assignment of error number 2. I think everyone's also agree that the law that prior bad acts can also be admissible if it tends to prove any relevant element of the offense charged. While the 1990s conduct does not tend to prove that Banks, on more than one occasion between April 14th and April 16th, 2016, engaged in conduct directed at Mr. Bryan. So then the question and issue also becomes whether or not it was admissible, and we'd say that it was inadmissible, to prove one of the 2 prior occasions of conduct. And it lacks probative value, the fact that it is so far remote in time, 15 years, and we also need to take into account the statute of limitations.
Now, can we go back? How does this fall within the assignment of error that was raised, this argument that you're making now?
That assignment of error was that the trial court erred to admit evidence of prior contacts during the 1990s as proof that Banks engaged in conduct directed at Brian on more than one occasion. So it falls into place that evidence was inadmissible for that purpose, to show that it was one of the two prior occasions. So I would argue that it does fall within the first assignment of error, because the assignment of error is saying not just that the evidence of the prior conduct in the 1990s is inadmissible, but it's inadmissible that Banks engaged in conduct directed at Brian on more than one occasion. So the fact that this is so removed in time from the April 14th to the April 16th date, it's too remote to be probative or relevant. And also, I think it's important to recognize that this is a misdemeanor case and the statute of limitations affects the court's analysis.
What about Mr. Stoller's argument that the statute of limitations only applies when the crime is completed, not when it's begun? And the argument that if it's begun in the 1990s but not completed until the 2000s, that the statute of limitations does not apply?
Well, Your Honor, it did not begin in the 1990s, because in this case, the warrant specifically alleged the time period of April 14th to April 16th, 2014. It's not a case where the warrant may have alleged that the conduct began in the 1990s, and we might be here on a different issue, a different assignment of error for that, but in this case, the conduct, the offense date in the warrant is April 14th to April 2000.
That really gets almost to a separate argument of yours, because the court allowed it to form the basis of the beginning of the stalking charge. That is the contact in the 1990s.
But it was not relevant to come in to prove, because the warrant said that it was April 14th to April 16th, that evidence of the 1990s conduct was too far removed to come in.
It doesn't matter if it's a continuing offense or not. If it's a continuing offense, doesn't that mean that you can use that the statute of limitations doesn't start running until the last act of the continuing offense, which is the 2014 offense?
But in this case, because the warrant didn't specify that the offense date was from the 1990s to April 16th, 2016, the offense, what could begin and stop, those two occasions of conduct, had to have occurred within the time period that the warrant alleged, which is April 14th to April 2016. And that ties in with the sufficiency issue as well. I'd like to bring up another point about the statute of limitations of what the Commonwealth essentially said, that the statute of limitations doesn't apply here because it's not an evidentiary rule. And the Commonwealth relied on, for that case, Ashdown, United States versus Ashdown. And when I took a look at the case, it's clear that that case actually supports Mr. Banks' position. And the Ashdown case, the client was charged with securities and mail frauds. And the court allowed prior conduct outside of the statute of limitations. It said that that was admissible, but it was admissible to prove the intent or the scheme. But what's important, so it came in for that prior bad act to prove the intent. But when you look at the gravamen of the offense for the mail fraud, the court pointed out that the mailings themselves occurred within the period of the statute of limitations. And because here, the conduct, like the mailings, the conduct here had to have occurred between April 14th and April 16th, 2014.
Well, what about Marlowe and Bissell and all those cases that basically say the Commonwealth can prove that the offense occurred at a time other than what's in the specified indictment?
Well, Your Honor, the Rajah case did note that there can be an expansive kind of time period. That's true. But the difference, what's distinguishable, especially in Rajah, is that the time period, the original warrant alleged a period of time of just one date in 2000. And the issue there was whether or not there could be an amendment to the warrant to allow a period between March and November 2011. So even the court said in that case that it was fine to amend the warrant to include those expansive dates. But even in the context of what the court was talking about, the expansive dates was between March and November 2000. So we're not talking, in the context of Rajah, 15 years prior. And furthermore,
but
here...
does that really matter? Was that dispositive in that case? Did the court talk about the distance in time?
Well, it didn't have to because the actual holding, and I'll say that this actually supports our position, that the actual holding was that there was no error with the amendment of the warrant. And here, the Commonwealth never asked for an amendment of the warrant.
Was there any reason for the Commonwealth to ask for an amendment of the warrant in this case?
If the Commonwealth wanted to introduce or to have that those 1990s conduct was sufficient to prove one of the prior occasions, then yes, they would have had to have asked the court to amend the warrant. But they didn't. And I want to keep bringing the court's attention back to the warrant, and that the warrant says that on or about April 14th through 16th, 2016, that on more than one occasion, Mr. Banks directed certain actions towards Ms. Bryant. So within that time period, there's only one conduct. The only conduct was Mr. Banks in the parking lot asking Ms. Bryant to be her doctor. That's the only conduct, and the statute is clear that there has to be more than one occasion of conduct directed at Ms. Bryant.
Counsel, let me go back to, this is another question on assignment of error. The assignment of error that pertains to the warrant states the trial court erred in denying Banks' motion to strike the charge of stalking and motion to set aside the verdict, where the Commonwealth failed to prove that Banks engaged in conduct directed at Bryant on more than one occasion during April of 2014. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a sufficiency objection, isn't it?
Correct. That's saying even if that evidence came in, which we're saying that was an error, it should have never came in to prove one of the two prior occasions. But even if it did come in, the evidence is still insufficient because the warrant alleges that specific time period. There is only one instance of conduct, even taking into account the 1990s conduct, there is only one instance of conduct between that April time period. And that, of course, was approaching Ms. Bryant in the parking lot and just simply asking if she would be his doctor. I see that I'm about to run into my rebuttal time, so unless the court has any immediate questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you,
Kim. Thank you. Hi, Mr. Stoller.
Good morning. May it please the court. Grace Jowett on behalf of the Commonwealth. First of all, let me start by apologizing. I believe I cited the wrong version of the statute in the brief. I apologize to the court and to counsel for that oversight. It was certainly not intentional, and I do apologize to the court for that. I don't believe it ultimately changes the argument substantially, but I do want the court to know I'm aware of that, and I do apologize. Getting back to the defense argument regarding the warrant, while the stalking statute's fairly a unique statute in the code, there's no other statute exactly like it. I think the closest analogy would be a recidivist-type statute, because a single act by the defendant cannot get you convicted of stalking. It takes multiple acts.
Not to interrupt you, but it's not a recidivist type of statute. A recidivist type statute would be like a petty larceny second, where there's a prior conviction that is the basis for the enhancement. Is that fair to say?
That is correct, yes.
Here we're actually looking at two discrete actions, at least, that you need to qualify as a basis of this type of violation.
That's correct.
So the question I have to you is more of a statute of limitations question. The General Assembly has given this type of offense a one-year period of limitation. They've done, in other cases, such as like a petty larceny, where they give it 5 years. Why? And that could also be a continuing offense. If they didn't want to limit this to a year period, how do you answer the fact that it's only given that year?
Well, again, I think, the statute of limitations runs from when the cause of action accrues. It doesn't run prior to that. So I think it would be correct to say the General Assembly said once the action or the acts are completed which constitute the offense, the Commonwealth has 1 year to bring the cause of action to trial. That's appropriate, and that's the way most misdemeanors are situated to do that. I think what makes this case different is the fact that stalking, and the case law generally says this as well, that stalking can occur over months, years, decades even, and that there's nothing regarding the statute of limitations argument that suggests that the prior conducts have to occur within a year of each other. Otherwise, you'd have a situation where someone could have a contact 1 year wait 18 months, have another contact, wait 18 months, and then you'd never have a cause of action accrued because it was spaced out beyond that 1 year each time, and therefore you'd never have the cause of action.
Well, if the General Assembly meant to do that, why wouldn't they include sort of a carve-out for that?
Well, I think what they, because I think, again, it starts running when the offense is completed. And I think the fact that you have multiple offenses in the 90s and no cause of action was brought, that while a cause of action could not now be brought for the conduct that occurred solely in the 1990s, that still constitutes one or more contacts, which is admissible to prove that there were multiple contacts when we get to the 2014 incident. Which is, again, why I'm saying it's not identical, but say it's analogous to the recidivist in the sense that when you charge an indictment for firearm possessed by a felon, the indictment doesn't allege when the prior felonies occurred. It just goes, on this date, you possessed the gun. One of the elements is you have to prove that he previously was a convicted felon. The indictment doesn't have to allege the date that occurred. For petty larceny third, you just say, on this date, he stole an item. They don't allege the dates when the previous felony larcenies occurred. That's an element the Commonwealth has to prove, but it's not alleged in the indictment. Here, we have the date in April 2014, he had contact, which is a contact which occurred more than once. Again, I don't believe the warrant's required to allege when those prior contacts occurred. I think it's part of the continuing act, and as long as the cause of action, which happened in 2014, was brought within a year, all the previous contacts, which are used to establish the prior contacts that show that this is ongoing activity on the part of the defendant, is perfectly relevant, material, and admissible to establish all the prior ones.
So is your posture position that for the purposes of the warrant, you only need to allege one time frame for one offense?
I believe
in terms of one action?
I believe the warrant's required to allege when the crime was completed. And here, they're saying in April 2014, he made a contact, which threatened the victim felt objectively threatened, and that was not the first contact. There were previous contacts of at least one other time, which shows a pattern of behavior. And here we have the action in 2014. Obviously, the Commonwealth's required to prove the prior contacts, which they did because of the contacts the defendant had in the 1990s. And as far as I pointed out in the brief, I believe, part of the issue regarding what it's in a warrant indictment is to put the defense on notice of what it is the evidence is going to be. And here, it's clear the defense was well aware of what the evidence was going to be. They filed a motion in limine. They had objections prepared. So this was not a surprise, obviously, to the defendant that this prior contact.
The evidence that was coming in was in reference to prove motive or what the intent was, as opposed to a basis of one of the prior acts.
Right. That was the Commonwealth's theory going into the trial, and I believe the trial court correctly found that in addition to that, it also established the elements of the offense under Kirkpatrick, both of which are under Kirkpatrick exceptions for admissibility. I don't think the fact the Commonwealth came in with two positions is dispositive because I don't think the Commonwealth can waive the law. I mean, it's up to the judge to decide what the law is. The court is certainly not bound by any legal concessions. And I don't think that was anything but a legal concession. Like, we think it's relevant for these two reasons. The court found, well, it's also additional for this third reason, which... I think the quote cited by the defendant proves the court said, I realize you object to my characterization of the evidence, and I'll let your exception to that. But again, it doesn't go to its admissibility, its relevance, its material, that it does in fact prove the prior requirement the Commonwealth has to prove, which is that there were more than one occasion they had this contact, which the contact from the 90s shows that this was becoming more and more aggressive on each encounter. At one point, he was grabbing on her car handle, saying, why won't you talk to me? Why won't you talk to me? He was notified by the police on multiple occasions, saying she doesn't want to have contact with you. The victim told him personally, I don't want you to have contact with me. And this occurred over a period of time. And that's, like Raj in other cases talked about, this happens over a period of time. That's the way stalking works, which is what makes this statute different from a lot of other statutes, is because you have multiple contacts over a period of time. Now, the General Assembly also did not choose to say contacts within 1 year only are relevant to this, or contacts within 5 years, or contacts within 10 years. They just say, on more than one occasion, there is no restraint on time of when that's admissible. For example, the DUI cases, they say second offense within 5 years, second offense within 10 years. There are ways the General Assembly can say it's relevant only within regarding a certain period of time. There's no such language in this statute. So I think the General Assembly meant it to be what it is, which is like stalking by its nature is an open-ended continuing offense. It did not intend to limit the Commonwealth's ability to prove prior contacts by limiting it to stuff that only happened in the past year or 2 years or when the most recent incident occurred. Did I address the court's concern?
Counsel, so the separate offense, continuing offense analysis for purposes of statute of limitation, is it the same kind of analysis as with a double jeopardy analysis?
Well,
again, is it legal versus factual?
I think it's legal. I think it's, and again, nothing's really a good perfect fit here because it is kind of a different statute, but I would suggest to the court that every incident of which the defendant has contact with the victim that's established as being unwanted, causing her objectively to feel unfair, each of those contacts could be admissible at a trial for stalking for an incident that occurred later, whether they're convicted or not. I think the fact they've previously convicted of it might be some type of enhancement, but it's still evidence of a prior contact. So whether it's an adjudicated bad act or just the contact itself, I think that would be admissible in any trial for future on charge of stalking. So if he were to contact her again one more time, I think, again, all the previous contacts would be admissible to establish another incident of stalking, because that's, unfortunately, the way stalking works. It is almost, unfortunately, a never-ending situation. Hopefully, this will be the end of it, but I think, and just to quickly address the issue regarding the statutory language, I'd argue the statute now makes it a situation where it's prima facie evidence that once the defendant knows not to contact, that then prima facie that it's objectively reasonable. I think what happened is that's been codified the law, because this case in Parker versus the Commonwealth and Supreme Court and Stevens versus Rose both say a defendant knew or should have known once they're giving notice that they don't want to have contact, that that's going to be cause objective fear in the victim. So whether it's codified now or it's just the law then, it's clearly the situation that once you tell the defendant she doesn't want to have contact anymore, the police have told him she doesn't want to have contact, no matter what kind of contact occurs after that, it's objectively reasonable for her to be fearful, either for bodily injury, sexual assault, or some other thing may occur. That's what the law was, at least as far back as 1997, so that was the law was during this contact. And he was certainly on notice that she did not want to have contact. She certainly did not acquiesce to any contact. And again, since the evidence here is not just bad acts, it's actually elements of the offense, the trial court did not err in giving limiting instructions regarding the conduct, which would have prevented the court from considering it for what it was legally admissible for, which is to prove an element of the offense. I'll be happy to address any questions the court may have. I'd ask it to your friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to jump right into one of the later points that the Commonwealth raised regarding the statute. Of course, as counsel acknowledged, it's a 2016 amendment to the statute, so it does not apply to this case. But then counsel went on to said, well, you know, even maybe that shows a little bit of legislative intent of where that's going, but even if, and this is what's important, is even if that amendment did apply, if it showed it, that prima facie presumption, that only goes to the second element. The second element being the intent of the defendant. And we have not raised an issue of the second element in this case. The sufficiency issues are the first element, which is whether or not there's been proven to more than one occasion of conduct directed at Ms. Bryan, or whether any fear was objectively reasonable. So, and that amendment only goes to that second element. So it's not, it doesn't relate at all here. I think what's important to kind of boil this all down is when you look at the other cases of where they brought prior conduct in that was of the past, that only really went in to show a prior bad act that goes to intent or relations of the party.
Counsel, let me ask you, do you agree that this is a continuing offense?
No.
Okay, why?
It's not a continuing offense because when you look at the other cases, all of the other cases so far, there's been more than one occasion alleged in the warrant. So when you look at Raja, when you look at those cases, the warrant specified a certain amount of time, and there were two instances of conduct within that time period of the warrant.
But the warrant wasn't challenged in those cases.
That's correct.
It was in Raja, it was an amendment. In Marlow, the warrant was...
But it still goes to show, Your Honor, that there has to be that two prior, the dicta, and goes to show that those two or that those one or more occasions of conduct occurred within the time period alleged in the warrant. And here specifically, the warrant alleged April 14th to April 16th. So the cause of action began with that one encounter in that parking lot, and there was no second occasion. That's why the evidence was insufficient. And that, and anything from the prior, from the 1990s, could not come in other than to show maybe a relationship with the parties, but then the instruction should have been given. I see that I'm quickly running out of time, so unless if there's any other questions, I'd, especially with the last assignment of error, rely on the opening brief since I didn't get a chance to read it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will come